From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
President Trump changed his mind about a lot of things this week. He says NATO isn't obsolete anymore, China isn't a currency manipulator anymore, and fixing the North Korean situation isn't as simple as he thought. Plus, the U.S. military dropped the mother of all bombs on an ISIS cave complex in Afghanistan. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Mary Beth Long. She was Assistant Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush and is a senior advisor at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Welcome, everybody. So this was a week that had a lot of people wondering whether Donald Trump is turning into more of a normal Republican. After last week's strike on Syria, Trump talked about the need for Bashar al-Assad to go and said how disappointed he is that Russia allowed chemical weapons to be used. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said U.S.-Russia relations are at a low point. But after a summit with the Chinese president, Trump's relations with China seem to be warming. He admitted China no longer manipulates its currency to subsidize exports. And he said he's willing to let China off easy on trade if China will help us contain the North Korean threat. And he changed positions on NATO, awarding the credit to himself, saying since people started listening to him about what NATO should do and how it should focus on terrorism, NATO has become unobsolete. Rich, what do you make of all this change? Are you pleased, surprised? Do you think it'll stick?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Most of it I favor, particularly what seems to be the drift away from protectionism. Now, it's too early to say that that's where he'll end up, because the currency manipulation thing was just a factual matter. I mean, he's wrong and was, you know, making strong statements based on outdated information about China's currency for a very long time now. And according to the New York Times, he had a meeting with U.S. business leaders and they just said, "You're wrong. They're not doing this anymore." And he finally gave in to the fact of the matter, which is always a good thing. But what we're seeing seems to be consistent with the eclipse of Steve Bannon in the White House. And perhaps he's on his way out the door, and the ascendancy of Jared Kushner and his ally, Gary Cohn, the former president of Goldman Sachs, who's a more, quote unquote, conventional Republican. Actually, he's a Democrat. So they want to have this moderating influence on Trump. What I worry about in the long term as a conservative is whether they begin to moderate him away from some of his more conservative positions, not just his outlandish ones.
Katrina, what do you make of this? I know you've been talking about one of your hopes with Trump has been that he would take on what you call the discredited foreign policy establishment. But at least some of this, like the softening on China, must be positive moves in your view.
Well,
right?
You're right, Josh. I mean, Trump trafficked in insult, not strategy, during the campaign, and there were partisan lies about Obama's foreign policy. But he did issue a direct and clear hit on, I would argue, a failed establishment foreign policy consensus that has failed dramatically, failed this country over the years. It's sort of stunning to read some of his words. I mean, he talked about the chaos we've created in the Middle East, and he urged surprising sobriety in the use of military force, and we must have, you know, geopolitical whiplash over the extraordinary uptick in military force and use in this past week. And not to be forgotten or lost, the number of civilian casualties reported in American-led strikes in Iraq and Syria has increased dramatically since Trump took office. So I think this country still deserves a great debate, a real debate about the limits of U.S. power, the need to focus seriously on a new realism, if I might call it that, the dangers of destabilization by use of our military force in the region, increasing terrorism, not destroying it. And I think Syria shows the limits of trying to resolve these crises through military force. And, you know, Mary Beth has studied these issues, but we're entering a century where many of the problems, whether it's nuclear proliferation, pandemics, global inequality, these are not resolved by military force. So you got the mother of all bombs, as it's being called glibly. It's, you know, destroying destroying caves, tunnels we built for the Mujahideen. So I close in thinking, you know, 16 years after we launched a war in Afghanistan, are we still consigned to endless wars? This president and his many generals seem to be suggesting in this last week's uptick in military action.
Mary Beth, what have you made watching this week? Because, I mean, for background for listeners, you're one of the many people in the Republican foreign policy and security establishment who was very critical of Donald Trump in the campaign and has somewhat shifted on that. Do you find this a reassuring shift toward normal from him?
I think that we can take some comfort in really two things. I'm a little bit hesitant to draw too many conclusions from the last couple of weeks. I think the one thing we all have to be really cognizant of is this president knew he was going to be tested. And I think a lot of what you're seeing is him responding and reacting to tests by the North Korean, tests by ISIS, tests by Russia and others. And I think behaving in a manner that conveys that American leadership is back, that he is willing and able and convicted in the use of force, and that he will do so in our best interests, as well as the interests of the international community. I'm not clear that it's time to draw a lot of conclusions about whether President Trump has changed his mind about the basic promises he made the U.S. Voting populace. I mean, one is the change of out of people like me who represent the quote-unquote failed foreign policy establishment. Mm-hmm. I think people did vote for a change, and I think he wants to make that change. But I do think he's shown that he's not willing to sacrifice doing the right thing, particularly in the case of Syria, and doing the things that are best in our interest, his signals to the Russians, his signals to the North Korean, despite the fact that it may not be his first choice. And I think you're very right about the North Korean and other problems. These are decade-long problems. But to show conviction and to show willingness to act in your first 100 or so days sends signals across the board that this is a president who's engaged, a president who can act, a president who's willing to act, and that he got a good response, I think, as popularity rose.
The thing I really wonder about here is when we see these, you know, these shifts toward normal action, whether they're normal actions that I like or don't like, they tend to be sort of one-off things where, you know, it's one thing to fire about 60 Tomahawk missiles at Syria, to drop a giant bomb on Afghanistan. But what we've seen with Trump and all sorts of initiatives is that he lacks attention span and that he lacks commitment, and that when things start to go south politically, he grows bored of them. We saw this with the healthcare bill. He grows frustrated. And so, you know, Eli Lake had this report for Bloomberg this week claiming that H.R. McMaster, the national security advisor, is drawing up a plan for tens of thousands of ground troops in Syria trying to fight ISIS. And, you know, sort of whether or not that would be a good idea. And my inclination is to think that it would not be a good idea. I just kind of can't see Donald Trump doing that. I can't see him doing something that would require that much political capital and that much sustained effort. And therefore, I wonder about the idea, you know, if he's projecting force, you know, if he fires missiles, he shows that he can fire missiles. But I wonder about his ability to demonstrate a sustained commitment to either a good policy or a bad policy.
I would wonder too, Josh. I mean, one thing we do know, and I talked earlier about the rise in civilian casualties, is Trump has ceded responsibilities to his military commanders in ways we haven't seen. And it appears he's paying little attention to operational details. To talk about a Trump doctrine at this point, I agree with Mary Beth. It's way too early, and I think it's almost farcical, laughable. But there's no question he's loosening the reins of the military. And if you want to be, you know, I mean, glib about it, I mean, America First approach to such problems seems to be putting the military first, second, and third. But I come back, I still think perhaps Trump will pivot in the face of a resistant international situation. But, you know, he was far more skeptical of regime change and the false promise of painless nation building. And I think it is still wrong to think that the United States can afford to police the world and still rebuild this country. And I'd make one additional point. We are on closer to the brink of a conflict with Russia than we perhaps have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis or Able Archer exercises in 1983. When you have the pro-Western president, Prime Minister of Russia, Medvedev, saying we're on the verge of military clashes, this is very dangerous. I mean, Mary Beth spoke earlier of her involvement with the nuclear issue. I'm not sure people understand how close we possibly are, even with the deconfliction in Syria back on in a weak way, this hotline. But it's a very dangerous moment. And I think Trump and his generals may not have what it takes to de-escalate, to think in tough, hard ways about what a responsible U.S. engagement with the world is.
Marybeth, what do you think about sort of contingency planning in those two areas, either if something goes wrong in Syria or if the North Korean dispute escalates? Do you think we're prepared for unforeseen circumstances there?
Well, the good thing is that in a transition from one government to the other in the U.S., we have contingency planning that's been drawn up by our military. It's been rehearsed. It's been war-gamed. It's been practiced. And in this particular administration, you have the general, the combatant commander, using old speak, but our CENTCOM commander is now our Secretary of Defense. So there's probably no one on the planet beyond him and McMasters and even General Kelly who would be more involved, more cognizant of the limitations, the strengths and the weaknesses of those contingency plannings. And that's why recognition of where we are, and I don't disagree with anything that's been said except to emphasize that out of the box, this president tried to do really two important things in the first 100 days. One is to engage his interlocutors at the highest levels in the most important countries. And he's done a phenomenal job at that. And in fact, he's been very, very aggressive. We've had him meet more senior leaders and more engaged leaders, the president of China, the king, et cetera. I mean, that's really important. Go ahead.
This is a mixed bag, though, right? I mean, the Xi meeting seems to have gone fairly well. But I mean, you know, we ended up with the president in a screaming match with the prime minister of Australia. I don't think all these leader meetings have gone well.
I don't think they've all gone well, but the act of engagement and the act that he's actually reaching out and establishing relationships, I don't want to pick on the Obama administration, but we didn't have too many close friends who had good, deep personal relationships with the previous administration. And it's going to be key to this one. And secondly, demonstrating that he won't be shoved around. He is engaged in foreign policy. I think to the surprise of many, I think many people thought the domestic agenda would dominate, and it still may be the point that dominates. But right now, he's dealing with being tested, and he's reaching out to key interlocutors to at least establish communication basis. We may not have done very well. There's actually a couple, I think, that we've heard about that could have gone better. But, you know, the guy's learning. Give him a chance.
I mean, there is. I mean, I wonder what Rich thinks. I mean, turning to missile strikes to salvage his failing presidency, there is that possibility, too. I mean, I haven't seen the discredited foreign policy establishment or the media applaud this president in such vigorous, heartwarming ways since those strikes.
It wasn't just the media and the foreign policy establishment, so-called. And this, Katrina, goes back to a point you were making about the international resistance that Trump might encounter. He's not encountering international resistance. Our allies are completely delighted. Our traditional Sunni Arab allies had felt abandoned by the Obama administration, which they felt was kowtowing to Iran, and supported these strikes vigorously. For them, it's a sign, as Mary Beth was saying, that the United States is back and is going to take a robust role in the world. And I think that the same is true in Asia. And the crisis here is not Syria. It's potentially North Korea, where you could have a showdown this weekend where the North Koreans are threatening to test another nuclear weapon. And we are, you know, saber-rattling that they shouldn't do it. How this plays out, I don't think anyone can be certain, but I think there's some chance that the North Koreans could actually back down, and we seem to be getting more action out of China than we've seen in years in terms of pressuring North Korea, which may have been a product of Trump's successful personal diplomacy in Mar-a-Lago, but also just the message that the Syrian strikes and the MOAB sent in Afghanistan, that this is an administration that this is not an administration that's afraid to use force and is trying to reestablish the deterrent credibility of the United States, perhaps with some success.
Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk some more about North Korea. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And Mary Beth Long, senior Pentagon official under President George W. Bush, is also with us. So we were talking about North Korea, and we got a statement this week that was one of these sort of classic Trump things, where Trump was describing how basically he was talking with President Xi, and he, you know, was saying, well, why don't the Chinese help us more with North Korea? Why don't they get the North Koreans to knock it off, and that she explained it to him, and now he understands that it's really a lot more complicated than it seemed. And this was sort of, you know, it's similar to the who knew healthcare could be so complicated statement. But the funny thing is, it looks to me like our policy goal here is more or less the same that it's been since under the Clinton administration, which is find a way to get the Chinese to lean on the North Koreans, use enough economic power to get the North Koreans to stop making so much trouble. And I guess the question is, the one way that I could see Trump getting this to work, where his predecessors have not, is if Trump could sort of credibly threaten to be kind of nuts and cause enough problems in the peninsula that the Chinese find it better, that it worth the cost of leaning on the North Koreans in an effort to try to maintain the status quo, that's the sliver of hope that he could achieve what his predecessors could not in terms of Chinese help.
Well, it wouldn't be too hard for Trump to do the madman posture, but let's step back for a moment, okay? It seems to me sometimes our media live in an eternal present, with each crisis presented as a kind of sui generis. Let's not forget, you know, Tillerson visited in March, right, Seoul, and talked about North Korea having a history of violating one agreement after another. In fact, it's worth remembering that President Bill Clinton got it to freeze its plutonium production for 8 years, 94 to 2002, and in October 2000 had indirectly worked out a deal to buy all of its medium and long-range missiles. The Bush administration promptly ignored both agreements and set out to destroy the 94 freeze. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 is rightly seen as a world historical catastrophe. But next in line was Mr. Frum's axis of evil, putting North Korea in there. We need to engage China. There needs to be innovative, creative, political, tough diplomacy. No one wants land armies involved in that region, and you do have to pressure China. But I'm not sure the threatening and the saber-rattling is as effective as Rich suggested with China. It's a proud country. I don't think the leader was ecstatic to be here as Syrian the strikes were launched. And I think it's going to need some deft diplomacy.
Mary Beth, what do you make of the Trump strategy on North Korea?
Well, I have to say, I think Katrina has it about right. I wouldn't agree with any of her characterizations, but putting this in context, I think she's spot on. I mean, the fact of the matter is we're 40 years from the cessation of hostilities in North Korea. And regardless of what happened under Clinton or Bush or Obama, we're in the situation where we have never used credible threats and any kind of kinetic or show of force action, even whenever they were manageable to the extent that those kinds of things are, with the North Koreans. I don't think she was happy for the Syrian strike to occur. I think he was less happy that the North Korean test occurred while he was here. So right back at you, China. The fact of the matter is China is the biggest patron. China has not used its leverage. We know that it has such leverage. This past week alone, it turned around coal ships that were headed its way. It also, for the first time in my recollection, at least recently, it allowed Russia to stand alone on the Syrian vote in the United Nations. And all of those are signaling that we have China's attention. We didn't have it before. The Chinese are very, very sensitive about face. We need to engage them, but we need to engage them seriously. And I think the president sent those signals this week.
Rich, it's interesting all of this happening against the backdrop of the staff intrigue that you talked about earlier in the West Wing. And I'm just wondering, I mean, Trump ran on a break with traditional Republican foreign policy. Is there any penalty for him if he doesn't actually provide that break?
I don't think so. I mean, absent an invasion of a country that goes really poorly, and I doubt we're going to be invading any countries and trying to occupy them on the ground. You know, Trump, the rhetoric, it was a mix of isolationism and Jacksonianism, which is, you know, you mess with us, you cross us, we're going to hit you hard. We're not going to come and try to dictate the political system to you or say what you should do on human rights. We're just going to hit you. And that both the Syria strike and the dropping of the Moab and Afghanistan are kind of consistent with that worldview. Now, we just don't know how much more he will evolve. You know, H.R. McMaster is apparently drawing, as you mentioned, drawing up plans for tens of thousands of troops in Syria, and some of his allies on the outside, you know, have written papers explaining how this would work. So I think it's credible that he's at least considering that. You know, does Trump go for that? Like you, Josh, I kind of doubt it, but I'm not entirely sure. So I think most of his base probably likes what he's done so far on foreign policy.
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think his base is, you know, ecstatic that he's decided to make nice with NATO. I don't think that's a big issue out in the country. I continue to think that this past week, the full frontal pivot away from sort of Bannon ideas toward Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council, and flip-flopping on Ex-Im Bank, flip-flopping on a whole set of issues which are aligned with the kind of right-wing populist agenda. That plus, if jobs don't come back and the healthcare stuff is a debacle months out after Trump's threats of this past week to renew it by sabotaging it, I think that means more to the base than what we're witnessing. Yeah.
Just to be clear about what we're talking about in the base. When I say the base, I mean like real voters who voted for Trump.
No, I agree.
But there is this kind of intellectual blogger tweeting base who, you know, they're isolationists, they're Putinists.
Okay.
You know,
they may really hate
NATO. But I doubt like any real Republican voter was voting for Trump because he was threatening to tear up NATO. And this is just another area. And Josh, we've talked about this over the weeks, how there's really no infrastructure and architecture around Trump's domestic agenda, populist domestic agenda. There's even less around the things he was saying on the campaign trail on foreign policy. You know, you looked at the Republican convention last summer. No one defended Trump's foreign policy in isolationist terms. They defended it in all the terms that you're hearing now. He's going to be strong. He's going to strengthen our alliances. You can't mess with him. He's going to bomb ISIS. That's the Republican.
Trade is also for trade. The trade agenda, the trade policies Trump pushed hard were a proxy for more than trade. And I do think you're witnessing a rollback, a Gary Cohnization, you know, Steve Bannon gone, Gary Cohn, long live the king. And you're seeing a kind of trade policy that is much more rooted in the 1% than the kind of populist trade policy that was on the campaign trail.
But I think there's another
something where he is.
Go ahead, Rich.
Sorry, as trade is something where he may truly be executing a reversal that possibly could cost him with some of his voters.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But I think there's both a policy and a political hazard awaiting the president here, which is that I don't think you can look strong forever by lobbing these occasional bomb attacks. I mean, in the Clinton administration, we had the one-off bombing in Sudan and the attack in Afghanistan. And ultimately, you can reach a point where there's only so much you can do by that. And if you want to really credibly threaten to interfere with hostile governments around the world, you have to be able to credibly threaten to invade. The problem is that then you sometimes have to invade in order to make that threat look credible. And I worry about Trump getting to a position where he starts to look weak unless he actually sends ground forces in somewhere. And I think that's a political.
Dangerous.
It's dangerous because it could get us in a ground war in Syria or
who
knows
politically.
Where it could, do you think that's right?
No, I don't. Actually, I think that's an unfair characterization. I think Katrina's right in that, you know, a lot of the electorate and not the base, and I don't even know how to describe the various individuals and groups that voted for Trump. But I do think I'm from small town Pennsylvania. I campaigned for Trump in North Carolina. I do think there's a big sector of voters out there that said, okay, you know, we understand you're getting settled in and we understand this looks good on foreign policy, but this is not why we voted for you. Where are the jobs? Where are the changes? And we haven't seen a lot of talk about that. So I think there's a growing skepticism, perhaps, is the way to characterize that. But on the alternative, you can drop a couple bombs and at some point you have to invade. That's just not an accurate characterization of all the tools we have at our disposal. And I think one of the things that we should be encouraged about this week is Donald Trump has reached out for one of those tools. The president has looked at NATO and said, you know, this is an organization that can respond, whether they're responding to me or previous things or just the changes in the world probably doesn't matter, but I can work with this organization, and that's a good thing. I do think there's a lot of military and non-military, diplomatic and other options that are available to us short of invading. So let's not make it seem like the Hobbesian choice. There's lots of things we can do for our foreign policy, some of which we tried and haven't been successful, some of which we might want to retry now that there is a credible threat that we will become engaged. short of invading.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
A word on Russia. Democrats and everyone else are right to be outraged over the Russian meddling in our election. But now that there's so many newly born Russian hawks in the Democratic Party, I'd love to see just a little bit of reconsideration of Obama's posture towards Russia, which literally could have been bought and paid for by Vladimir Putin. It started with the misbegotten reset. It ended with U.S. complicity in the Russian deception over the sham chemical weapons deal with Syria. It's hard to see how Putin could have hoped for a better policy from the United States government, and indeed, now he's getting worse.
Mary Beth Long.
This is the year 2017, and if I had thought that at this age and at this point in time that I would see the use of indiscriminate chemical weapons against a foe, I would have thought that humanity had moved beyond that point. And here in the United States, we have a wonderful tradition of marching in the streets about things that we like, things that we don't like, things that we oppose. I was very proud to see the women's movement march earlier this year after the Trump election for all many, many, many good reasons, not of all of which I agreed. We march in the street about use of bathrooms. We march in the street about all kinds of things. And I'm not trivializing any of those things. But the fact that the world hasn't gotten to the street for the use of sarin gas in Syria, and many of those uses affecting disproportionately women and children, is just amazing to me. I think sometimes we need to step back from all of this conversation and remember our humanity, particularly with this holiday season for many. Why aren't we on the street for the use of chemical weapons?
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
So this past week in Kansas, in a congressional district that Donald Trump won by 27 points, Republicans managed to eke out a win in a special election by less than 7 points. And the special election coming up in Georgia next Tuesday, first-time Democratic candidate John Ossoff has raised a huge amount of money, leads in the polls, could win the seat outright in the first round of voting. Recruitment is up, and I think that a Democratic base has been energized in important ways, moving from resistance now to reconstruction and rebuilding political power. And it may well be that it could deliver a, quote, wave election that wins Democrats the House in 2018. And I think both parties now consider that a genuine possibility.
Normally, I'm against Justin Trudeau fanboying, but the Canadian Prime Minister did a really good thing this week that deserves praise. He's making good on a campaign promise and introducing legislation that will comprehensively legalize marijuana in Canada, making it the second country in the world to do so after Uruguay. This is a good move. Prohibition has failed, and adults should be able to use marijuana if they want. However, there are important choices facing Canadian provinces as they decide exactly how to legalize marijuana. There are right and wrong ways to do this. Marijuana is not as harmful as alcohol, but there really are problem users, and you want to find ways to legalize while restricting marketing, imposing taxes to keep prices high enough, and doing various other things to discourage overuse. We should watch what Canada does and hope they set good examples for U.S. states as legalization proceeds down here south of the border. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Mary Beth Long. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.